We're going to listen to a story in a few minutes because it's. But it's so warm in here, Sarah, I'm going to be melting.
Yeah. I did find a fan to put it there by the door.
Does that have anything to do with why the lights
are all
out outside?
Yes, they have all the outside power shut down. In fact, I almost passed up the entrance. I couldn't even see it. And then we got here, all the HVAC systems are off, and so we don't have any ventilation. So,
why?
Run outside and take a big breath.
Get a flashlight.
Dennis, they say why the power's off?
They don't have anything going on tonight except our class. So,
so next Monday, next Tuesday.
Yeah, next Tuesday it'll be out. Okay. So if I can get everybody's attention, we'll get started a little early because the room is really warm and I am.
I'm just fine.
So I know John has hearing that he can't hear, so if someone needs to hit John, let him know we're starting. We're going to start. Okay, let me have everybody's attention here. We are going to have a movie tonight, the DVD, 24 minutes. I wanted to play that after I do the introduction, but I had such a hard time getting things set up. The air just came on.
Yeah.
Did you, Victor, did you ask for that?
No.
Victor, I'm just going to pray, open up with a prayer. Thank you, Lord, for bringing some air. So I think first thing we're going to do is just open with a short prayer. And Victor, I ask you to do that for us, if you don't mind.
Father, we just thank you for bringing us here today and to learn about you and learn how to defend your word and your faith that you have given us. Lord, I just pray that you will put the things that we need to remember in our memories. Pray that you make us attentive to the words that the speaker is going to bring forth and the illustrations particularly show us how we can illustrate the truths presented to us to believing friends to make their faith stronger and to unbelieving friends you give them a faith. Thank you, Lord, for this day and for this hour, this Christmas season. In Jesus' name.
Amen. Thank you. Fantastic. So a little bit of explanation. About 5 weeks ago, I gave a talk on Made in the Image of God, and I talked about how inventions show a lot about the progress of the hominids, and only in about the last 10,000 years that we see a big burst. And that was one of the slides, and I printed these out to give to people. I forgot, so there's some back there. If you didn't attend a particular lesson, it probably doesn't make a lot of sense. But anyway, I had made a bunch of them, so I wanted to put those out. Announcements, let's see. Sarah, you can help me with these. Second is no class next week.
No class next week.
And the next class will be on January 2nd, and it will be a continuation of this Privileged Planet. The DVD I'm going to show tonight is this one. It's great. It's about an hour, but only the first 24 minutes is really good. And after that, Guillermo Gonzalez gets into talking about his particular research. And so it's the first 24 minutes is excellent. And if anyone wants to borrow this, they can. And by the way, if you Google Privileged Planet, there's a YouTube of this video. You can watch it. Someone apparently just videoed it and put it on YouTube. So we'll see it there. So I have a couple of books that I've used to help with this. One of them is called Improbable Planet by Hugh Ross. Lots and lots of technical information in it. And a recent one out there is another RTB book, Is There Life Out There? I've read about two-thirds of this. It's excellent. It shows that the possibility of finding extraterrestrial life is fairly remote, given this way this planet looks and all the things that have to come into existence. I was watching the news before I came here. My son had called me and said there was a release about a UFO that was spotted. How many people saw that, those F-18s? It turns out it was years and years ago. So everyone's always looking for extraterrestrial life. Not everyone, but a lot of people. And everybody remember the program called SETI?
Yeah.
Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. It's still going on. People are looking for a signal. It's so interesting because you have people looking for some kind of repeatable radio signal or any part of the electromagnetic spectrum, and that's intelligent life. You can look around and see all kinds of evidence for intelligent life, or for intelligent design, excuse me, intelligent design, just by looking at the fine-tuning of the universe and looking at how privileged this planet is and how unique this planet is. How many people have heard of the term exoplanets? Yeah. So recently we had, and I'll get into this later, and we've had some advances in instrumentation so that we can start to try to detect exoplanets. And they use simple things like the change in the, as a planet moves around a star system, there's a shift in the gravity, and so there's a shift in the wavelength. There's microlensing. There's, as a star passes in front of the, as a planet passes in front of the star, if it's in the same plane we are, then you see a little dimming of the light. And what they can infer from that, best I can tell, is the mass and the orbital parameter, the orbital distance. And from that, that you'll see a release. Another exoplanet has been found. There's over 2,000 as of the beginning of this year that have been cataloged. And the media will pick it up a lot of times as something like planet Earth. Well, it's a long, long way from identifying a planet with all the unique characteristics and properties that we have. I want to jump right into this video because it's excellent. It's 24 minutes. It's really entertaining. I hate to do this first because then when I talk a few minutes later on, it's going to look pretty bad. So what I'll do is I'll stop it, and if people want to leave, it won't hurt my feelings at all. All right. I'm going to stand back here where it's cooler.
Should we get some more of the lights?
Yes.
Okay. I can get them all.
Oh, yes. It's going to be loud enough, I think.
Late in the summer of 1977, an historic mission of exploration was launched. Twin spacecraft, christened Voyager 1 and 2, broke free from the Earth's gravity on journeys to the outer reaches of the solar system. Their primary destinations were the four giant outer planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. For 13 years, the Voyagers probed these mysterious worlds at close range while collecting data and transmitting stunning images back to Earth. Among thousands of pictures of planets and moons, perhaps the most memorable was recorded on February the 14th, 1990, when Voyager 1 approached the edge of the solar system, then turned back toward the sun. With its wide and narrow-angle cameras, the spacecraft captured unprecedented views of our home star and six of its orbiting planets. One of them appeared as a small, pale dot engulfed by a ray of sunlight. It was the Earth, from nearly 4 billion miles away. While the world gazed intently at this pinpoint of light, timeless questions about its meaning, purpose, and significance suddenly took on new relevance. And once again, as in ages past, we paused to consider our planet's role within the grand scheme of the universe. mystery of the Earth's significance in the universe has challenged philosophy and science for more than 2,000 years. Early perceptions were shaped by the work of the Greek scholars Aristotle and Ptolemy. They taught that the Earth sat motionless in the center of the heavens while the moon, sun, and other stars and planets revolved around it. This geocentric view was the foundation of Western cosmology for 18 centuries. Then, in 1543, the Polish astronomer Nicholas Copernicus ignited a revolution. In his book on the revolutions of the heavenly spheres, Copernicus argued that the Earth was not stationary, but instead orbited with the other planets around the Sun. For the first time, a correct understanding of the mechanics and structure of the solar system was in sight.
The idea of the moving Earth seemed to violate some fundamental principle, but Copernicus somehow had the mental power to imagine what even to him seemed absurd. So he thought the impossible. The Earth moves. And once you imagine the Earth moving instead of the Sun, the mathematics of that cosmic machine started to make sense. It was the key that unlocked one of the great mysteries of the universe.
Copernicus had laid the cornerstone for modern astronomy. Yet 400 years after his discovery, the empirical fact that our planet was not the center of the solar system had evolved into what is now known as the Copernican principle, the idea that the Earth occupies no preferred place in the universe.
Copernicus had a theoretical way of explaining the apparent motion of the planets across the sky. That's all it was. It wasn't a theory that told us whether or not Earth was special, or whether we played some importance in the scheme of things, or whether every place in the universe was the same as every other place. Nevertheless, this reinterpretation of Copernicus became prominent in the 20th century. It's often called the principle of mediocrity. This principle says that our location and our status are mediocre, they're unexceptional. As a result, we should not assume that we are in any way privileged or that the universe was designed with us or beings like us in mind.
The Copernican principle and the concept of the Earth's insignificance was popularized during the 1970s and 80s by the late astronomer Carl Sagan. In his best-selling book, Pale Blue Dot, Sagan wrote,
"Because of the reflection of sunlight, the Earth seems to be sitting in a beam of light, as if there were some special significance to this small world. But it's just an accident of geometry and optics. Look again at that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe, are challenged by this point of pale light. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark."
One reason for the widespread acceptance of the Copernican principle can be traced to a discovery made on this mountaintop overlooking Los Angeles. Between 1921 and 1926, the astronomer Edwin Hubble used this telescope to make some of the most important discoveries in the history of science. Through the window of the Mount Wilson Observatory, Hubble unveiled the true magnitude of the universe.
At the time that Hubble was doing his work, many astronomers believed that the galaxy, our galaxy, marked the edge of the universe, and there was nothing beyond it.
Edwin Hubble altered this perception of the universe when he used the most powerful telescope of his day to photograph indistinct objects in space. Long thought to be nearby clouds of gas and dust, Hubble determined that these patches of light were actually individual galaxies, many as large or larger than our own Milky Way.
The implication of what he found was that the universe consists of, indeed, billions of galaxies, each with many billions of stars and planets. And it was a universe with a wealth of numbers and variety that transcended the imagination of both layman and astronomer. He in effect enlarged the boundaries of the universe.
Edwin Hubble revealed that the Milky Way galaxy, encompassing more than 100 billion stars, including our sun, was a mere pinpoint of light in the universe.
When Hubble found that there were many galaxies, we saw that our galaxy was nothing distinguished at all. Just one ordinary galaxy among billions. And that's the ultimate extension of the Copernican principle.
More than 80 years have passed since Edwin Hubble's discovery. Yet today, its profound implications still evoke a fundamental question. Does contemporary scientific knowledge actually confirm the Copernican principle's primary claim, that the Earth and the life it sustains exist without purpose or significance in the universe? Planets and complex life are abundant throughout our galaxy and the rest of the cosmos. Perhaps no scientific endeavor has been influenced more deeply by this idea than the research program called SETI.
Well, SETI, which is, of course, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, is trying to do exactly that. We're searching for extraterrestrial intelligence. In other words, we're looking for aliens that are at least as clever as we are. Now, we try and do that not by trying to go there the way they do in the movies all the time or waiting for them to come here. We try and find the aliens, if you will, at home on the basis of eavesdropping on signals they might be sending our way. So we use large telescopes pointed at other star systems to try and find these telltale signs that there's some cosmic company out there.
Since 1960, SETI researchers have utilized radio telescopes throughout the world to monitor transmissions from distant regions of the Milky Way. While no definitive signs of intelligent life have ever been detected, these investigations have triggered much speculation about the possibility of extraterrestrial civilizations.
Estimates vary all over the place. Carl Sagan thought there might be millions of civilizations that are kind of contemporaries of ours. I can imagine that within the Milky Way galaxy, the number of contemporary intelligent civilizations, I think, is probably in the thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands. But the bottom line, actually, when people ask, well, why do you think that they're out there, is that the universe is extraordinarily rich, extraordinarily vast. The number of stars that we can see is on the order of 10,000 billion star systems. So unless there's something very, very special, miraculous, if you will, about our solar system, about our planet Earth, unless there's something extraordinarily unusual about it, then what happened here must have happened many times in the history of the universe.
The assumption that habitable planets and extraterrestrial life are abundant has inspired not only the SETI program, but also the new science of astrobiology and the search for biological evidence of living organisms, past and present. Since 1995, this search has extended beyond our solar system, as astrobiologists have identified more than 100 planets orbiting nearby stars. Each of them is a gas giant, much like Jupiter. While few scientists believe that these alien worlds can sustain even simple life, their discoveries represent important steps toward answering a question that will shape astronomy in the 21st century. Are habitable planets rare or common in the universe?
I'm an astrobiologist, and the area that I've done the most work in lately is the field of extrasolar planets. What motivates me is just to examine the conditions necessary for life and look elsewhere in the universe and see if those conditions are met anywhere else. And the answer could be yes, and the answer could be no, and either answer is interesting.
Guillermo Gonzalez works as a research scientist in NASA's astrobiology program. His interest in this field is tied to his early fascination with the prospect of life beyond the Earth.
I grew up in the 1960s, and like most of the people of my generation, I was really amazed by the Apollo lunar landings, and that really inspired me. Had something to do with my getting interested in astronomy. In my early years, I came to believe very strongly that there must be other civilizations out there, and that the galaxy was teeming with life. And so I was a strong supporter of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. My belief wasn't based on any real hardcore scientific arguments. It was just the impression that I had that the galaxy was such a big place. And I didn't give the other side of the equation much thought. In other words, there's two sides of the equation. There's the number of stars, the number of trials, if you will. But the other side is the factors. It takes a lot of factors to have a habitable planet and a planetary system.
For Gonzalez and other astrobiologists, these factors, required for the Earth's habitability, became the focus of extensive research.
We demonstrated in dozens of different ways the laws of physics and chemistry that pertain in the laboratory, anywhere on Earth, apply anywhere in the solar system, apply anywhere in the galaxy, and in many cases out to the most distant galaxies that we can see.
There are indeed unchanging physical laws in the universe that apply to the entirety of the universe, that they're not localized in one place.
This consistency in the laws of physics and chemistry has led many researchers to conclude that the factors necessary for complex life on Earth are also the best parameters in the search for habitable planets elsewhere in the universe. Most serious discussions about these factors begin with the same prerequisite, liquid water.
All the searches that are being done for life elsewhere, their starting position is a terrestrial-class planet with water.
It is now widely recognized that the chemical properties of water are exquisitely suited for carbon-based life. These properties include water's ability to dissolve and transport the chemical nutrients vital to all living organisms, and its unmatched capacity to absorb heat from the sun, a process critical for regulating the Earth's surface temperature. In liquid form, water is an extraordinary substance, and its existence hinges upon another factor essential to complex life, a planet's distance from its home star.
It's like what they say in real estate, location, location, location. A habitable planet lives in what we call the Goldilocks zone. It's not too hot, it's not too cold, it's just right. And when I say just right, I mean just right for water. Liquid water really helps define the habitable zone. If it's too hot, again, the water just boils away. You just can't get condensed water. It's too cold, as in Mars today, it freezes out.
Within our solar system, the habitable zone is relatively narrow, beginning well outside the orbit of Venus and ending short of the orbit of Mars. If the Earth were just 5% closer to the Sun, it would be subject to the same fate as Venus. A runaway greenhouse effect with temperatures rising to nearly 900 degrees Fahrenheit. Conversely, if the Earth were 20% farther from its home star, carbon dioxide clouds would form in its upper atmosphere, initiating the cycle of ice and cold that has sterilized Mars.
The presence of liquid water is a necessary condition for life, but it's not a sufficient condition. After all, there may be liquid water under the frozen surfaces of Mars and Jupiter's moon Europa, but there's very little chance that complex life exists in either of these places. You see, contrary to what the Copernican principle might suggest, the recipe for life is much more complex than just add water.
If a recipe for a planet capable of supporting complex life really did exist, then what ingredients beyond liquid water might be required? The list of necessary factors continues to grow.
We live on this paper-thin crust. If the Earth's crust were significantly thicker, then plate tectonic recycling could not take place.
The Earth's crust varies in thickness from about 4 to 30 miles. It consists of more than a dozen tectonic plates that are in constant motion. This dynamic geology regulates the planet's interior temperature, recycles carbon, mixes chemical elements essential to living organisms, and shapes the continents. Deep within the Earth's interior, the movement of liquid iron generates a protective magnetic field essential to complex life. If our planet was smaller, its magnetic field would be weaker, allowing the solar wind to strip away our atmosphere, slowly transforming the Earth into a dead, barren world much like Mars.
We need an oxygen atmosphere, and the oxygen-nitrogen atmosphere that the Earth has is necessary for complex life.
As seen from space, the Earth's atmosphere glows as a thin blue ribbon of light. Measuring less than 1% of the planet's diameter, it is composed of a mixture of nitrogen, oxygen, and carbon dioxide. As a result, our atmosphere ensures a temperate climate, protection from the sun's radiation, and the correct combination of gases necessary for liquid water and complex life.
For a size of planet like Earth, our moon is big. The current thinking is that if our moon didn't exist, neither would we.
1/4 the size of the Earth, the moon's powerful gravitational pull stabilizes the angle of its axis at a nearly constant 23.5 degrees. This ensures relatively temperate seasonal changes, and the only climate in the solar system mild enough to sustain complex living organisms.
If we find life out there, especially complex or even intelligent life, it will be around a star similar to our own.
We orbit what is known as a spectral type G2 dwarf main sequence star. It is well suited for our needs. If the sun were less massive, like 90% of the stars in the galaxy, the habitable zone would be smaller. To remain within its boundaries, the Earth would have to be positioned closer to its star. Here, increased gravity would lock our planet's rotation into synchronization with its orbit. While one side of the Earth continually faced the sun and increased radiation from solar flares, the dark side of the planet would lay shrouded in perpetual cold and ice. It is unlikely complex life could tolerate these drastic extremes in temperature.
A lot of things went right on Earth to have yielded complex life, absolutely.
The number of factors that have been postulated has grown. Currently, the typical number you would see is, in a typical list, would have something like 20.
We find that we need to be at the right location in the galaxy, that we're inside the circumstellar habitable zone of a star, that we're in a planetary system with giant planets that can shield the inner planets from too many comet impacts, that we're orbiting the right kind of star that's not too cool or not too hot, that we're on a planet that has a moon that can stabilize the tilt of its axis, that we're on a planet that's a terrestrial planet, a planet that has a crust that's just thick enough that it can maintain plate tectonic activity, but it has enough heat in its interior that it's still circulating its liquid iron core so it can generate a magnetic field, that it has an atmosphere that has enough oxygen to allow for complex organisms to survive, that it has enough water and enough continents to allow for the diversity of life or an active biosphere that we need to support complex creatures such as ourselves. All these factors have to be met at one place and time in the galaxy if you're going to have a planet as habitable as the Earth, which you need for complex and even technological life.
In an attempt to estimate the probability of attaining this combination of factors simultaneously, some researchers have developed equations assigning a conservative 1 in 10 value to each factor deemed necessary for advanced life.
if every element has to be there at the same time. You have to multiply the probabilities. And that's what makes the probability at the end so small. You've got 10% of this and 10% of that, and these things rapidly multiply to exceedingly small numbers. The numbers on the order of 10 to minus 15, which is 1/1,000th of 1/1 trillion. And it's a number like that that you have to compare to the 100 billion stars that are in the galaxy. 100 billion is a very large number, but 1/1,000th of a trillion is much, much smaller. On their face value, these probabilities are speaking. What they're telling us is this can't happen, or this is very unlikely to happen in the galaxy. And that's where the evidence is pushing us.
There are many probabilistic resources in the galaxy, but on the other side of the coin are all these factors that you need. You have to get just right in order to have just one habitable planet like the Earth. And that leads me to conclude that, yes, we're rare in the galaxy.
That's where I wanted to stop it. But from here on out, he talks about his research. Can someone turn on that light over there, or just so I can now get set up? It's going to take me a few minutes, and I'm going to have my head down so that everyone wants to leave and can. Okay. We are now just to get this started. Oh, I've got to pick up. Oh, my goodness. So this is such an interesting topic for me. And
all, what was the name of that DVD?
Privileged Planet. And so, okay. It should be PC, should be home. So it's Privileged Planet, the book that I've used, the Improbable Planet by Hugh Ross, and this other one I've been reading recently, Is There Life Out There? So, Sarah, you can jump in here if you want. The interesting thing is that astrobiologists know all this information here.
I was actually just thinking about this as that Jet Propulsion fellow was talking, because I got into this discussion on Twitter the other day with an atheist, one of these kind of science worshiper types who's saying, oh, well, you know, we have these equations, and as we get to know more information, it'll just become more probable. And I said, no, it's the opposite. The more you know, the worse the statistics get. So we need something like if you say, like, there's 10 to the 22 probability of finding life, just if you say, well, there's this many possible worlds in the observable universe. The problem is, when you count up the number of parameters that need to be just right, and when you do it like they said there, you have to multiply these probabilities together. Now, let's conservatively just say there's a 10% probability of each of these parameters being in place. As soon as you get to 22 of these, now you've got a problem. 10% to the power of 22, now you've got a problem. You don't have. You're right there. I'll just keep blabbing while he's doing this.
This doesn't stay up long
enough. You're in trouble.
I may have to shut my computer down. Oh, there it is.
Hugh Ross has identified something like 300 parameters, the odds of finding intelligent life just by chance are just almost zero.
If I could add to that, as time goes on, they're finding more and more of these fine-tuned parameters, so it's becoming less and less likely to occur.
So this is, there's several titles that you can use. Rare Earth Hypothesis is something people kick around. You see books, papers written on that. Privileged Planet is another term, and Improbable Planet is another one. I get goosebumps thinking of watching this DVD. I have quite a bit of information, and that's why we're going to break this up into two presentations. And I'm going to just give a background introduction tonight, which is about a dozen slides, very high level. In fact, as I was watching the DVD, maybe this is actually better to follow the DVD, because there's a lot of things he went through really fast, and I'm going to cover some of those in this introduction. So, no one agrees on what conditions are for life. It's interesting. This is off of the NASA website, and habitable environments must provide three things. Extended regions of liquid water, you heard that in the DVD. complex organic molecules and energy sources to sustain metabolism. At least those three, okay? We're going to cover in this discussion next week, January 2nd, about 18. I'm going to go over about 18 in detail. I'm going to show you, give you a reference to the scientific journal for almost every one of these discussions, not a Christian website, but a scientific journal reference, and people know these facts. So the criteria for the planet, I think of as three things. One is composition. What's the geochemistry of it? What's the atmosphere? What is the soil, for example, is one that just popped into my head. I don't have it in my presentation, but this is where geology meets biology. Just the soil that we have to grow things is just enormously complex. So the composition of the planet must be right. This is a good example. This is a bad example. Orbital parameters, you've already heard that, must be right. And chemical reactions there. And then the star, the stellar system of the sun, has to have the right mass, luminosity, and high metallicity. All these terms we'll define later on. But I want to get into that. This is going to be, next time we meet, it's going to be a little more technical. But this is just, no one would argue with this particular slide. This is straight off of conditions that people know have to exist for complex life. So what is complex life? Well, life involves complex biochemistry, but complex life involves extraordinarily complex biochemistry. And I'm not going to get into that discussion now, but we'll have a talk by Morty Pony, hopefully, about that, the complexity of the body. But it also means that the planet is very improbable because it must have a combination of unique thermodynamics. What do I mean by that? Well, there's a phase diagram for liquid water. The thermodynamics of the planet must be finely tuned. The physics, which encompasses lots and lots of parameters, must be tuned. There you see a fission reaction. It's uranium decomposing, producing energy. It turns out that the core of the Earth, about half of the energy comes from radionuclides radioactive decay that's taking place in the Earth. And that core is important, that hot core is important for the magnetosphere. It's also important for plate tectonics. It's important for a lot of things. So for whatever reason Earth was formed, we have a high level of radioactive decay in the core, which keeps that core hot. Also, we must have right chemistry. We have this abundance of fuel. If you just think about all the hydrocarbons that we have here on Earth, not only that, but we have an oxygen atmosphere to burn them. And so I know hydrocarbons are going out of favor now, but at least natural gas is still in favor, but coal and other ones are gasoline or not. But we have this abundant ecosystem that other planets just simply don't have. So you hear this a lot too. Is carbon necessary for complex life? And this is addressed in detail in this particular book in one whole chapter. A lot of chemistry on carbon. Carbon is a very unique molecule. It turns out that there are over 10 million carbon-based molecules been cataloged, over 10 million. Anybody ever take organic chemistry? So I was wanting to be a chemical engineer when I was a freshman. I went in to take a class in organic chemistry. I said, this is just, and then Phillips teaching it had burns, all chemical burns, all over his body. And I thought, and the place smelled like formaldehyde. And I thought, that's my daughter calling. I guess I better not take that. So I said, this is terrible. So I after the first semester, I left and went into aerospace engineering. I was so happy. But carbon is an amazing molecule. And there's just some examples of these rings and chains that you produce. And some of these molecules, they're macromolecules. They're huge in size. So it's the basis of all organic molecules. Oxygen is involved in over 100,000 of these molecules. There's an example of a carbon-oxygen reaction to produce CO2. And there's other additional essential elements like nitrogen, sulfur, plus other ones. But if you look at these organic molecules over here, everything that we think about, carbohydrates, proteins, lipids, nucleic acids, amino acids, all these are organic-based. And I was just, I know that organic molecules break down at an elevated temperature, and it's typically a range of temperatures, if you look it up, it's about 70 degrees Celsius, about 160 degrees Fahrenheit. Above that temperature, you'll see most of the organic molecules essential for life decompose because of the protein folding that takes place. An egg is a good example. Whenever you boil an egg or cook an egg, or you can cook it on a hot sidewalk or a hot car, the egg white itself is protein, and it's this complex long-chain molecule that is folded over, twisted around, and made into this very, very intricate shape. And it's just amazing when you look at an actual computer-generated image of that. When you heat that up, it unfolds. Now, it makes for a nice-tasting breakfast. Oh, sorry. So I heard we eat sticky eggs in the morning, so doesn't necessarily. Some people don't like eggs, especially. But it makes for a nice breakfast. But the problem is, if the temperature gets too high, then you can't have this complex organic molecules. So other people say, well, there's silicon-based life. So it turns out, and they address this in the DVD, the periodic table that we know, we pretty much assume those same elements exist everywhere in the universe. That's not something you can prove, but we know that the physical laws, we haven't seen any variation, but as we look back in time and space and through the universe, we see the same molecules. So we assume the periodic table is the same. If that's the case, there's only two elements that really could possibly support life. One is carbon and one is silicon, because of the complexity that they have. But there's a lot of reasons why silicon would not be a suitable representation for life. It turns out that observing the spectra in the universe, there's over 200 molecules as of 2017 that have been identified, and over 60 of those, or 30%, are carbon-based. And less than 10 of the 200 are silicon-based. When I was reading Jeff's book on that, it was interesting. I was thinking, silicon, life form, well, that's artificial intelligence. That's what we use here to build computers. So we do have two forms of intelligence on the complex intelligence on this planet. We have us, and then we have the fairly sophisticated computers and artificial intelligence that we've developed over the years. But that's silicon-based. Carbon-based life, silicon-based, I think it's pretty, most people agree that carbon would be the essential element, not silicon. So this is the first time we get into something, a discussion about age of the universe, and this is, I'm just going to say, this is my position. This is not a position that causes Christians to have conflict or concern. If the people are young Earth in here, that's fine. Honestly, no one really knows if the Earth is young or old, but the scientific evidence points to an old Earth. And I look at this as the way God prepared Earth through creation miracles. And we'll talk about some of these as we get along, but these are some things that you should probably be aware of. About 4.4 billion years ago, Earth was about 4.54 billion years old. Shortly after it formed, all the theories show there was a major collision event with a planet about the size of Mars, and that's where the moon came from. The moon that we have, large moon circulating or orbiting close to the Earth, which has a lot of beneficial effects. Another thing interesting happened about 3.8 billion years ago. We had this late heavy bombardment. When Earth was beginning to form, a lot of meteorites impacted the Earth, iron, metal rich. And so as the Earth was cooling, all the heavy elements, heavy metals, are going to shrink to the core. You got uranium is there. Uranium is very heavy. And you're going to have light silicates on the surface. But right near the end of this formation period, we had a lot of bombardment, late heavy bombardment, and with asteroid impacts, asteroids, bringing in a lot of the heavy metals that we need for our existence today. Going to the periodic table, you look, we have this huge center core of metals, aluminum, they have aluminum oxide, but iron and so forth, vanadium, a number of metals that are necessary for complex life. About 3.5 billion years ago is when the magnetosphere was created. That's essential for protecting the Earth from harmful radiation. One of the big issues that when astronauts or thinking about a long trip to Mars, the probability that there will be a ionizing radiation hit that craft during that 18-month journey out, 18-month journey back, are very, very high. Everyone knows that. The spacecraft cannot protect against that. So if they hit, if there was a large solar flare or some other event, the ionizing radiation would be lethal. And so it happens quite often. Earth is protected, has been protected for 3.5 billion years through the magnetosphere. Oxygen came into the Earth later on. Very interesting, a photosynthesis process created by cyanobacteria, that's blue-green algae, in the ocean. Before that time period, there was almost no oxygen on the planet. This was a huge oxygenation event when the oxygen level went up to around 21%, actually went a little higher and it came back down. And that's what is another a big creation event. About 1.8 billion years ago is when the plate tectonics began. This is an old slide. I was just reading this recently. Now they think it's back about 2.5 billion years. No one really knows exactly when plate tectonics began. But plate tectonics, that motion that we have, which is responsible for earthquakes and volcanoes, is essential for life. You may ask, why is that? Later on, next January 2nd, we'll get into this and talk about each one of these things in detail with references and show why that's necessary. And about 500 million years ago was this Cambrian explosion when all the body parts, body plans came out in about a 1 to 2 million year period. These are look like miracles to me. There's not this slow evolution. There's really distinct major events that happen over a short time scale. So you heard this term about the Copernican principle. It states that Earth is not in a central, specially favored position in the universe. That's a not the original Copernican principle. It was just that the Earth was moving around the Sun. Of course, the Sun is also moving through through space, but the Earth orbits the Sun. But later on, people generalized that to really say that we occupy no special place in the universe. And in fact, one of Carl Sagan's famous quotes, we are made of starred stuff or star dust. It turns out that all that you see on that periodic table we'll talk about that. All these elements were created by star formation, first and second and third generation of stars, and each successive star has a higher level of higher atomic weight elements. And when they actually go supernova, explode their guts, and you get all of these higher atomic weight elements into the universe. So the universe went through these creation events to produce all the stuff that is. Planets are created. It's kind of an interesting quote, the Lord formed man from the dust of the ground, breathed into his nostrils. Well, dust of the ground is essentially star stuff. It's stardust, if you like.
Dennis, interesting note, in astronomy, we actually refer to the stellar material as dust.
The stardust. Yeah. Because it's just fine particulate matter. It's out there. It's either frozen gas particles, which are small, or it's in solid state if it's metals and other compounds. I don't know why I put this slide in. I wanted to take it out, but the only reason I put it in here is to give you a perspective because, and they talked about this in the discussion here. The Earth, if you look at this and move down from that lower left image, and go into looking at the solar system, you sort of see its place in the solar system. And you see Earth's place in the Milky Way galaxy. Then you see a local group, and then you see a local supercluster, and then you see the universe. The universe is huge. It's about 10 to the 24th meters in radius, not diameter. Diameter is 96, yeah. That's the known observable radius of the universe. So, there's an interesting quote in Jeremiah that I didn't put up there, but it's 33:22. It talks about, as countless as the stars of the sky and as measureless as the sand on the seashore. Jeremiah. I looked this up. Again, I waste a lot of time sometimes doing stuff like this, but I looked up to see how many, is anyone ever trying to make an estimate of the number of grains of sand on all the seashores? It turns out several graduate students in physics have done this, and they've published it. And you can do that by looking at the coastline, the depth of the sand, width back, and you take a large section of that and you actually measure the number of sand grains and maybe some small volume, and you estimate. Turns out the estimate is about 10 to the 20th. That's a huge number. And you heard them talking about the number of stars in the galaxy, in the universe. There's about on the order of 100 billion galaxies, on the order of 100 billion stars in each one. That means it's maybe 100 billion, 200, 300 billion, something like that. You put those two numbers together and you get something like 10,000 billion billion. A huge number of stars, far exceeding the number of sand grains on all the beaches. People have argued that why did God make, if there was a God, atheists say, why did he make such a massive universe just for one little planet? No one has an answer either way. I guess my answer is because he could. Why not? It shows his majesty and his greatness. I mean, he made this massive universe and put one privileged planet in the entire universe. So there's a couple of things that were didn't really discuss in detail in that introduction, but the galaxies, there's about three basic types, and I had Sarah look over this, and she did some little edits for me because she's an astrophysicist. The three basic types of galaxies are elliptical, spiral, and what is it? Well, that's the nebula, excuse me. Spiral and irregular. And so an elliptical galaxy has very little gas and dust, stardust, and elements, so it's mostly old. Red stars are not suitable for life. An irregular galaxy has a preponderance of explosive star formation and quasars. So really, most astrobiologists and astrophysicists think the only real type of galaxy that could possibly be suitable for life would be a spiral galaxy. We live in a spiral galaxy called the Milky Way, which gets me to a couple of fine-tuning parameters, and there are others, 16 or 18, we'll discuss later. You heard this about the Goldilocks zone. It turns out that Milky Way is a spiral galaxy. We are in one of the, actually not in one of the arms, but sort of slightly outside of one of the arms where there's not a high population of stars. And so a planetary system must be close enough to the center so it has a high sufficiency of heavy elements, but it has to be far enough away so the large gravitational perturbations are not going to upset it, or that dangerous radiation from the center doesn't preclude life. So you have to be in a certain region in a spiral galaxy for all these conditions to exist. So that's called the galactic habitable zone. I'm going to skip that slide and move back to this and then do this one. You heard this one also, the stellar habitable zone. It turns out that when you are in a planet in a stellar system, our sun, this is called the solar system, you have to be at the right place for liquid water to exist. So this is a plot of different stars with different masses, and this one this is relative mass of one would be the sun, and this is sort of a scale as you go out and looking at planets. You saw that habitable zone, and there's only a certain region from a star where you can have liquid water, and this is actually looking at a main sequence star. And the sun, you heard that was a type G main sequence star. If we were closer in or outside, you wouldn't have a habitable environment. And as you see this thing moving down, it shows you it's different size stars. You have to be farther away, smaller, you have to be closer in. You heard that discussion in there about if you get too close and you get a phase lock of the planet with the sun or the star, and you have one face toward the star the whole time, just like the moon, this lock phase locks with the Earth. So this is sort of an introduction here, and I guess I wanted to do this first, but I think it works fine after that DVD, and I'm going to stop there because what I'm going to do pick up next time is the fine-tuned parameters, and I haven't broken up into solar parameters, solar and Earth parameters, and chemistry parameters. And so, you can't see that. basically barely you can see. That's the way I do my organizational. And I go to each new section, I just highlight that. So we're going to go through these three classifications. There's going to be about 16 different parameters I'll talk about to give you detailed evidence as to why those are important for having a fine-tuned rare earth or improbable planet. So I'm going to stop there. It's about 2 or 3 minutes after the hour, and take questions, and Sarah can take questions, or anybody else if you have questions about this. So starting on January 2nd, we'll get into this. It's going to be kind of technical. I have to apologize for that, but it's really important for, I think, to convey to people that the Earth is a very privileged, very special place. And it's not just liquid water alone that determines the planet is habitable. There are many, many other parameters that are necessary. You heard him say 20 in that DVD. Hugh Ross has identified about 300, you're right. I think I've looked at it. I think there's probably 30 or 40 that are really, really hard to refute. Some of them, as you get higher numbers, get a little nebulous, somewhat gray areas. But the ones we're going to cover are really rock solid, and the evidence comes from astrobiology journals, astrophysics journals, well-respected scientific journals, talking about the rare properties that the Earth has. Now, they don't really say anything beyond the fact that there's a low probability you will find life elsewhere. And this may not be a great tool for Christian apologists, but I think it is, because when I hear people talk about there's no special place, we're always a lot of alien life forms. Life doesn't have to be carbon-based. It can be silicon-based. You can refute all those arguments with pretty sound scientific evidence. So I'll stop right there, and we'll take if people want to leave, we can. But we'll stick around here, answer questions if you have any.
So I just have something I want to throw out and ask you about. Obviously, this is incredible. The statistics.
Right.
To it. It's just unbelievable. Evidence of a creator. But do we, as Christians, really, I don't know if we really have to defend that there isn't life somewhere else, right?
I agree. This is not a great apologetic tool.
Oh, I think it's great.
But
couldn't there still be life somewhere else that God has created?
So that's a good question from a theology perspective. And I asked Eric Hoehn that 10 years ago. I don't know if you know Eric Hoehn. He's sort of a theological gatekeeper. And he had a pretty good answer, if I can recall. He said, the Bible is silent on that. Clearly, it does not say that the earth is the only place mm-hmm. where God has created creatures that have a special relationship with him. It doesn't say that. But if you really look at the Bible carefully, it sort of implies that. that Jesus came. It doesn't say Jesus stopped off at planet Earth and then a couple of other places. It implies that, and I happen to believe that. But it's not something I would argue one way or the other on.
He does mention his other flock, though.
He does say, I have sheep that you know not. And some people have brought that up as maybe there are other...
Yeah, Doyle said that, yeah.
But that doesn't discount the fact that he is our God.
Right.
And our creator.
Yeah. It's a good... It's to say that there's... The Earth is not special, and that it's not a privileged planet, and that there's lots of places like that, I think it's just going way too far. But, yeah. That's a really good question, because I remember when I started looking at this, I wanted to ask Eric Hoehn about that. So what does the Bible say? He says silent on that. But he said the implication is clearly that there's one place.
Well, that's something that I encounter being active on social media, and I get people asking me, here's this Christian astrophysicist, let's get her opinion. It's like these atheists who say, life isn't that special. There's probably lots of planets that are populated out there. So it's a counter to that whatever we find, let's at least be informed about the fact that an incredible converging of all of these different things has to come together in order to have life as we know it.
Yeah.
So whatever
exactly
it is
right.
special.
Yeah.
think one thing we can count on is that we are the only humans. There may be some other type of life, but Christ died for humanity. I don't think he goes around to multiple places and rises again. I think that we're special in that situation.
Yeah, I believe that too. But it's something that, I believe that too. Anybody else have a comment? Yes, John.
It seems like one of the purposes of Carl Sagan's, in fact, I think he had this idea to say, okay, let's take Voyager and turn it around and aim it back toward the Earth. And, you know, the name of the book was Pale Blue Dot, I believe,
yeah.
Something like that. He's basically trying to show, you know, look, see how insignificant Earth is? You don't need a God for that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
But it turns out life and our universe is incredibly fine.
Yeah.
I mean, if you see a fine-tuned machine, you know there's a designer.
Yeah.
And it turns out that's the way our Earth and life and universe is.
Yeah, it's just a way to refute that argument that Earth is not special. Yeah.
Here's something kind of interesting I discovered. I'll just come up with something to turn around. When I was teaching astronomy at the university level, I would hand out at the beginning of the semester a questionnaire to ask students, what is your biggest philosophical challenge as far as astronomy goes? And being in Texas, I assumed, especially when I was teaching at Southwestern, which is a Methodist university, I thought most of the students were going to say, well, I see a potential disagreement between my faith and what you're going to teach us. Almost nobody answered that. By far, the biggest challenge that the students had is they said, I feel insignificant compared with the scale of the universe.
Oh.
And so this kind of tool is something that's really important to help students who are kind of susceptible to this scientific nihilism. It's like, how do we possibly fit into this? We're so insignificant. And they would get really depressed about it. Not like off, like I look at the universe, I'm on. They would get really depressed about it. And so I would talk to them about this stuff and say, no, it's highly specialized. The universe has to be this big just to have one planet with life on it like this. So this, it's another apologetics tool.
Yeah, I
was just curious, does the magnetosphere extend to the moon?
Yeah.
It does.
Okay. For sure. Yeah, it's pretty big.
But it sort of drops off
very, it drops off
very
yeah.
rapidly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I realized that the moon trips were a lot briefer than the 18 months to Mars. But then of course they were a lot closer too.
Yeah.
So the danger of traveling to Mars would have two problems. One is you're farther away, and number two is it's a lot longer.
You're not protected. Yeah.
Right. So I was curious if Apollo was protected by the magnetosphere.
I think
so.
To some extent.
Yeah. I don't,
good question.
I don't know. I think probably at that time the space race kind of people didn't worry about it, you know. we got to beat the Soviets. But it's not cosmic ray. The heliosphere protects us pretty much from the cosmic. Although cosmic ray, there are high energy cosmic rays, which are nuclei. They are really dangerous.
It's the X-rays that would probably kill you.
So, but the universe is a very hostile place. That's another thing from outside of the Earth. Once you get outside of the Earth, it's very hostile. It's radiation is intense. It's ionizing radiation. So life forms like us, you know. Complex life forms, they basically can't exist if they get hit with ionizing radiation.
Makes the Earth kind of seem like a Garden of Eden, this whole universe, and just this one place where God wants us to feel at home. You know?
Yeah, I always say it's like the cradle of it. It's like it's like a Garden of Eden, you're right, it really is. If by imaging other planets, especially in our solar system, you look at them, they're just barren. They're just either the frozen gas planets or they have some terrestrial planets, but they just either no atmosphere or an atmosphere which is completely toxic. If you saw Total Recall, Arnold Schwarzenegger it didn't last long. His face blew up. That's probably about what would happen. organic molecules just don't exist. That's just a known fact outside of it. of something very, an environment that's like ours. It just don't exist. Yeah.
Are most of the explorations of Mars, for instance, looking for a second home in case we blow ourselves off the planet? Or is it more extraterrestrial life?
It's not a second home, I would think. I mean, getting there is so expensive from just a cost perspective. The energy, which is cost, it's just curiosity. Yeah, we do these things, and we talked. I talked about this at the beginning. Why, you know, when we did that, made in the image of God, we do things that are not necessary for our existence, or not part of a random evolutionary scale. We have curiosity, and so.
Seems like even if money wasn't involved, it seems like it would be just logistically impossible to transfer that much weight to.
Stephen Hawking talks about we need to find another home, but I think he's just getting to that point in his life where he's just saying some wacky things.
Oh, there is a fun book. I wish I could remember the title or the author. Is a fellow who's sort of a Marsologist. He's got a PhD in some kind of science, but he's really gotten into this idea of colonizing Mars, wrote a whole book in a narrative style about what it would take to colonize Mars, and then he actually makes it sound kind of plausible. They've got all the raw materials you need there to build
It's a shelter planet. It has probably what you need.
You can have fish farms there. You could grow fungi and other things. Wouldn't be the most fun existence.
But, it's the soil. They don't have soil, even. I mean, like we have, it's taken a billion years, hundreds of millions of years to create this soil. And there's a program on one of the educational programs, channels about a year ago, talked about where, I loved it, where geology meets biology. They looked at the complexity of soil. And it's just, it takes a long time for that to happen. And it's alive. It's not dead. Mm-hmm. And the material you find on a planet that has no atmosphere, no magnetosphere, it's just dead. There's nothing that survives. So it has to grow things, even though that movie that came out recently.
The Martian.
Martian, yeah. he's able to convert the soil into something, or the barren planet into soil. That was a little far-fetched.